OMG, fuck this guy, fuck this guy, fuck this guy, fuck this guy. Are you fucking serious? Finally, the interview broke for a short jazz interlude, the only time I have ever been grateful for a jazz interlude during an NPR show, and so I tweeted the journalist, "That is not in the book. It was in a galley that wasn't for quotation, so thanks for that." "Thanks for writing it down," she replied. "You should never have thought it," someone else wrote. But then something started to happen, something Justine hadn't experienced on the night of her shaming. A babble of voices began arguing with each other about the line. Some were in my defence. People started circling the freelance journalist like the terns on the beach. I tweeted her to ask if I could send her a private message explaining what I meant by the line. She said okay, so I did, adding that I hoped she was okay and not feeling beleaguered. She sent me a nice reply. Then people started tweeting that I was mansplaining her in private messages, and so I quickly backed away. Everybody's positions were hardening. Given that all I ever want in life is for everyone to be reasonable, I found this toughening of stances stressful. My mini-shaming had me up all night worrying in a hotel room in Minneapolis, and because the book examines how shamings can mangle a person's mental health, I tweeted the next morning that even my mini-shaming had an impact on mine. "Stop whining," somebody wrote. As Heather Malik put it in the Toronto Star, on Twitter, the pain of the person being shamed is considered minor, almost risible, and often enjoyable. It so happened that I have been ganged up online, and I have also been beaten up by actual gangs of men on the street. The actual beating is, surprise, exponentially worse. Lurking and somewhat underdocumented in the tales gathered here is the fact that as agonising as these experiences are, men often survive them just fine. But Justine Sacco? Eh. Corey Sicker, a former Gawker editor, New York Times, 19th of April, 2015. Actually, Justine was fine now. But 4 weeks later, in mid-May, a 47-year-old Israeli government clerk, a man called Ariel Rounis, was accused of racism. A black woman had been trying to renew her passport at his office in Tel Aviv. She later reported on her Facebook page that a female official had refused to allow her to use a special fast lane for people with babies. White people were being allowed to use the lane, but not her. So she complained to the office manager, Ariel Rounis, who rudely brushed her off. "I told him exactly what had happened," she wrote, "and that I felt I was discriminated against due to the colour of my skin. I told him that my baby needed a change of diaper, that the little one was asking to go to the bathroom, and that all I was asking was to be afforded equal treatment to that being given to the other mothers who came to the office, nothing more. However, I expected nothing less either. He told me that if I was complaining about discrimination, I should get the heck out of his face. All this happened in front of dozens of people. I tried, I really tried, but I shed a tear, and then another one, and maybe a few concealed ones. My son, who is 5, comforted me and asked that we leave." Her Facebook post was shared 7,000 times. In response, Ariel Rounis wrote his own Facebook post. "Up until 2 days ago, my life looked rosy," he wrote, "but each Facebook share is a sharpened arrow driven into my flesh. All my life's work has at once vanished with the thrust of a word, disappeared. For years I have worked to make a name for myself, a name now synonymous with the vilest of terms, racism. This will be my fate from now on." He posted his message. Then he put a gun to his head. His body was found a few hours later. "This morning I awoke to some of the worst news I have ever heard. I am sorry with my entire soul for the loss of a life. For years I experienced discrimination in Israel. The only time I told my story, a man was hurt. No one is more sorry than I am. If I could, I would keep silent this time too," the woman who had made the original complaint. The aftermath was disappointing. Instead of taking a sober moment to contemplate the seriousness of internet shaming, the powerful weapon was turned like a boomerang on the woman who posted the complaints in the first place. Alison Kaplan Summer, Haaretz, 26th of May, 2015. The range of insults levelled against women is without doubt far worse than those levelled against men, but one's ability to bounce back from a social media shaming doesn't seem connected to gender. As I write this, three male clients of the cheating site Ashley Madison are reported to have taken their lives after hackers published their details. "Learn your lesson and make amends," the hackers wrote. "Embarrassing now, but you'll get over it." By the time you read this, I'm sure there will have been more suicides, given that the hackers released 34 million names. Sometimes it seems like we'd rather people commit suicide than go through a boring day on social media. I once asked a shamed man, someone I eventually left out of the book, to describe to me how his shaming had felt. He replied, "Worse than being badly beaten up by my father." "At least," a female friend said to me, "all those shamed men are getting an idea of what we've had to go through for years." Suddenly, white men like me were getting to experience something that women and people of colour have long known, what it feels like to be objectified, which is progress of sorts, in a way. I remembered something that Mike Daisy had said to me. "I'd never had the opportunity to be the object of hate before. The hard part isn't the hate, it's the object." I suddenly knew exactly what he meant. I was getting misdefined by some people as a racist who thinks getting raped is no worse than getting fired. And I was starting to misdefine myself as someone who felt the need to leap into pretty much any unfolding ambiguous shaming and take a counterintuitive position. It was becoming unseemly. On the 12th of June, I read in The Guardian, "Civil rights activist Rachel Dolezal misrepresented herself as black, claim parents. The biological parents of a prominent civil rights activist in Washington state have claimed that she has been misrepresenting herself as a black woman when her heritage is white. Rachel Dolezal is an academic, chair of the Office of the Police Ombudsman Commission in the city of Spokane, and president of its chapter of the African American Civil Rights Organization, NAACP." Jessica Elgert, Guardian, 12th of June 2015. What a crazy, extraordinary story, I thought. So mysterious and complicated. What led her to fake being black? Maybe she has a mental illness, or maybe she doesn't. Maybe she feels about colour the way some transgender people feel about gender. Or maybe she doesn't feel that way. I had 1,000 questions. What kind of family life did she have? Was she a good NAACP chapter head? If she was, did it matter that she faked being black? Maybe it did matter. I didn't know how much it mattered. A journalist's favourite question is why. Why opens doors into new worlds. I wonder what Twitter is making of it, I thought. And so I went on Twitter. "Rachel Dolezal, you can appreciate a culture without appropriating it. The fact you can't grasp that is one reason you're a racist idiot. And Rachel Dolezal has been living in blackface her whole life. Seems cut and dry racist to me. And we should apply a super strength relaxer onto Rachel Dolezal's head and not wash it out. Allow it to burn through her skull and racist brain. And make no mistake, Rachel Dolezal is a self-absorbed, psychotic and sociopathic racist." And so on. I didn't have the stomach for it anymore. On social media, we'd had the chance to do everything better. But instead of curiosity, we were constantly lurching towards cold, hard judgment. We knew nothing about Rachel Dolezal that morning. Maybe she was everything Twitter assumed she was. But what was wrong with waiting for a bit of evidence? Maybe Rachel Dolezal was reading all the tweets and thinking about killing herself. That was possible. I was sick of us forever making damaged people our playthings. And so I tweeted, "Feeling incredibly sorry for Rachel Dolezal and hope she's okay. The world knows very little about her, her motives." I went to dinner. I chatted away with people at the table. It was nice. I went on Twitter. Someone was calling me a white supremacist. I went back to the dinner conversation. Everyone was nice. I went back on Twitter. Somebody pretending to be me had written, "Dylan Roof is good." Dylan Roof was the racist who murdered 9 African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina. Someone told me I had no right to weigh into Rachel Dolezal's story, because being white, it wasn't my story. He added that unlike her, he had no choice in being black or white. As a black man, he was racially profiled every time he walked down the street. He was genuinely angry with me for chipping in the way that I had. I explained my reasons, that after 30 years of writing about complicated, spiralling people, I had opinions on how to consider them. But he was right. In all the hardening of positions, I'd become a caricature. I complained to Twitter about the man who, pretending to be me, commended the Charleston racist murderer. Twitter responded, "We have determined that it's not in violation of Twitter's impersonation policy." I felt a flash of rage. I saw someone tweet, "It's strange to think that something I could type in this box could ruin my life." Twitter suddenly felt like a doomed company, intimidating, even dangerous. My friend, the documentary maker Adam Curtis, emailed me. "I have this perverse theory that in about 10 years sections of the internet will have become like a John Carpenter film, where among the ruins there are fierce warrior gangs, all with their own complex codes and rules, all shouting at each other, and everyone else will have fled to the suburbs of the internet, where you can move on and change the world. I think those suburbs are going to be the exciting, dynamic future of the internet, but to build them, I think it will be necessary to leave the warrior trolls behind." I had enough. I quit Twitter. The world outside Twitter was great. I read books. I reconnected with people from real life and met them for drinks in person. Then I drifted back onto Twitter. Someone told me I'd have done myself a favour and avoided much of the criticism had I ended my book with a set of rules outlining when shamings were and weren't okay. It hadn't crossed my mind to do that because it sounded like the kind of thing lifestyle coaches do. And anyway, it seemed pretty obvious to me. During 2014 and 2015, videos were surfacing from Staten Island, New York, and Ferguson, Missouri, and Waller County, Texas, of police brutality against people of colour. People were dying. Eric Garner, Michael Brown, and Sandra Bland. In McKinney, Texas, a cop was filmed pulling his gun on a group of unarmed black teenagers at a pool party. He violently wrestled a girl to the ground, using his body weight to pin her down. She was wearing a bikini. "I want to call my mom," the terrified girl screamed. It didn't need saying. Maybe it did need saying. That using social media to distribute those videos was a world away from calling a woman who'd just been in a train crash a privileged bitch because she wanted her violin to be okay. One was powerful and important, using social media to create a new civil rights battlefield. The other was a pointless and nasty cathartic alternative. Given that we are the ones with the power, it is incumbent upon us to recognise the difference. Of course, there will always be people who fall squarely in the middle. The least we can do for those people is to be patient and curious instead of instantly judgmental. And when we find ourselves shaming people in a manner that echoes their transgression, that should set off alarm bells. Maybe there are two types of people in the world. Those who favour humans over ideology, and those who favour ideology over humans. I favour humans over ideology, but right now the ideologues are winning, and they're creating a stage for constant, artificial high dramas where everyone is either a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. We can lead good ethical lives, but some bad phraseology in a tweet can overwhelm it all, even though we know that's not how we should define our fellow humans. What's true about our fellow humans is that we are clever and stupid. We are grey areas. And so, unpleasant as it surely will be for you, when you see an unfair or an ambiguous shaming unfold, speak up on behalf of the shamed person. A babble of opposing voices. That's democracy. The great thing about social media was how it gave a voice to voiceless people. Let's not turn it into a world where the smartest way to survive is to go back to being voiceless. This has been an Audible Studios production of So You've Been Publicly Shamed, written by John Ronson, narrated by John Ronson, producer Mike Charzuk, copyright 2015 by John Ronson, production copyright 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.